Damien. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 3rd, 2003, which makes me almost 4 years old. Actually, 40 in February, if you care to really know. But, right. One day at a time.
Look it.
Bless you, Mary. You're my best friend. I don't know where I'm going tonight. I'm just glad I chose to come here. AA has changed my life. You hear that at many speaker meetings and many times in rooms. And that's the case for me. I'm speaking here for the second time. The first time I ever spoke was a year ago when OB asked me. And for some reason, a little more difficult today, and I don't know why that is, other than that sobriety offers challenges on a daily basis, and I'm choosing to walk through it as a sober person today, and oftentimes the challenges of each and every day require every bit of program and spiritual awareness and connection with God that I can muster at a moment, and this feels like one of them. So I got Kleenexes and the big book and everything. I really didn't know where to take this talk tonight, and that's why I asked God early on, about 15 minutes ago in the Broadway room, to speak through me tonight, because I'm a wreck. But good news is I'm here. I'm also in touch with the scope and nature of what this program offers. And one of our dear friends, Roy, is in the process of transitioning to the next life. And I had the opportunity to speak to him this week. And when I asked what I could do, he said, carry the message. And that's what I intend to do tonight. There are people that I look around and see in this room that have guided me through every step of the way in my journey to connect with God. And my story is not unique. I am not one of the under the overpass drunks. I just did stuff that was disgusting when I drank. I was a pretty blessed child in many ways, with the exception that my family was alcoholic. You know, I was the youngest of five children. Born 9 years apart, so I kind of grew up like an only child, and somewhat resented by my brothers and sisters, since I never had to fight over the pork chops, so to speak. And my sister reminds me every now and then that my mom squealed with glee when I was born because she finally got a pretty one, you know. And that it's what it was, you know. It's kind of odd, the resentments that grow up in families and that you take on and make a part of you. And so even, you know, little statements like that as a child that just wanted to be loved embedded themselves. And some of the earliest memories in my life are ones of fear, when my father would get drunk and rage through the house and slam doors and so on and so forth. I didn't drink in high school. I was too afraid oftentimes to do anything wrong. And my story is a lot about fear. And that's what I remember growing up, was just always being kind of afraid of everything and everyone. And don't particularly know where I'm going right now. I always felt felt that there was something inside of me that needed tending to, and I didn't know how to get there. It was this sort of struggle on a daily basis to try to be okay. Even though I probably was okay, I just never felt okay. And had a lifelong relationship and bond with animals. And oftentimes in the fearful times in my life, I would turn to my pets that I had for comfort and excelled in many ways, you know, with the pets in my life, and they carried me through some of the rough times and things like that. And high school, I always just wanted to be noticed. I wanted to be the best. I was an honor student in high school. I was one of those second grade readers that got put in the fourth grade reading class, and you know, things like that. And took tennis, and my coach was a Wimbledon judge who said I was an amazing tennis player, but I would vomit every time I would, you know, get ready to go to tennis lessons, and finally just quit because I was scared. And I just sort of tripped through life that way. You know, I would make calculated risks. If I thought that I could do something with a fairly high percentage chance of succeeding, then I would do it. And if it meant that I might fail, I would turn the other way. I was offered a scholarship to the University of Wisconsin. Go Badgers, by the way, that Go Blue stuff. Although Michigan did beat Wisconsin this year, and I'll give you that one, whatever. When I entered college, I entered a university that was well over 44,000 students, coming from a 600-student high school, and was planning on being a veterinarian. And when I got to school, I felt amazingly overwhelmed. You know, this is just a boring story of somebody that finally one day picked up alcohol at a beer kegger, took a drink, and thought, ugh, and then took another drink and went, wow, okay, let's go, giddy up. And that's where it started. You know, I really didn't take my first drink until I was 19, I think. And coming from Madison, Wisconsin, the land of beer and bratwurst and cheese, drinking is a national or state pastime. And so I went to a university that is consistently rated the number one party school in the country. And that's what I did. I learned to party and drowned out the fear. I avoided relationships all through high school. I was afraid of boys and afraid of being not good enough and afraid of, you know, everything. It was just this child who didn't know how to grow up, and I'm not any different. I think fear runs rampant in these rooms on a daily basis, and it often just what keeps us out there for so long. And even when we come in and out, there's a fear of doing something different with our lives. And you know, that's why it's 8:15 and I'm not sober yet. I know, I said I wasn't going to be. I was going to be sober by 8:15. I find my story boring, but and what affects me is the sober walk, you know, the things that I do to stay sober on a daily basis. But at school, I again, you know, being a student that excelled, I was in a place of uncertainty and discontent and fear. And when it came time to take calculus, I said, I can't do it, so I'm going to change my major. You know, I changed my course of my life because I was afraid to take a math course. And, you know, it's those weird little decisions that we make that we don't see as life-changing, perhaps, but do change our life. Well, you know, I looked at my transcript and I had a ton of English courses and I did well in English in high school, so I became an education major. And never taught a class in my life after I graduated. I graduated and searched out careers in the animal field. I subbed for a while, and I worked as a teacher's assistant, but it was just this life of flailing and fumbling and tripping over myself, looking for some solution that was speaking to me that I didn't know how to talk to. God was never a part of my life. Our family, you know, my dad really spurned religion. My mom would take me to church. We'd toddle off to church on Sundays, and I got ticked because I had to write sermon reports, you know, and turn them in on Sundays, and I didn't think I should have to write a report on God and stop going. I just told her I wasn't going to go anymore. I found, looking back as I've, you know, walked through the steps and reflected on my experience before coming into the rooms, that I did connect with God at different times, and oftentimes it was when, you know, my life, my family was stripped away and I was riding a horse, you know, out in the woods or fishing by a lake. Nature always connected me, and it still does, and that's one of the gifts my family did give me growing up was the gift of appreciating this world outside of just where I live. We couldn't afford to fly places on vacation, but we would travel in a car and see the, you know, the grandness and the majesty of this country. And I was given the gift of a trip to England. My family, I had a deep sense of history. My father was a World War II veteran, and ran a tight ship. He was a first generation Norwegian authoritarian, and an angry man in a lot of ways, with a really wicked sense of humor. Cynicism and sarcasm were the words of love in our family oftentimes. My mom was a very gentle person, but also a person that was always looking for something. She was a Depression-era baby that grew up in Dust Bowl, Kansas, and didn't have crap growing up, and in turn, sort of looked for my father for protection, but also there was this antagonizing relationship, a love-hate thing that went on for 52 years until the day he died. And so family relationships were always a bit twisted. My oldest sister was sort of my mom, and in later years I resented that. And, you know, it's just kind of this floating, I would seek out, and I think Julie or somebody who spoke recently talked about seeking solace in other people's families, and I was, you know, one of those people. I would just run to find that peace and comfort and sense, and just Miss Peggy giving me a hug tonight, you know, that's where this program, you know, comes in. And it's like the redefining of who family and what family means to us. And that's been a huge gift for us that walk in lonely and unattached and desperate for love in a lot of ways. And anyway, I just continued through the next few years, escalating my drinking as I tripped through life. And that's all I can say. I stepped into AA 7 years before I actually came in this last time, and I didn't drink for like 9 months, but that's when I started doing some other stuff and coming down with NyQuil, you know. Never quite willing to surrender. Thinking I had to figure it out, find that solution, figure it out. You're stupid if you don't know how to live your life simply. There are people around you that have everything, and and you got crap. You know, that's just that mindset that kept existing in my head. And I got into trouble in 1999 with a DUI. Never took care of it. I kept on drinking, just drinking and drinking. And I was functional to the extent that I would continue to have jobs, but I'd leave them because I was wronged or spurned or wasn't the right job. I wasn't reaching the right level. You know, I was just a dunce, a dork, you know. And never really did anything well except show dogs, you know. And that's like the one thing in my life that I just constantly, you know, kept nurturing. And then in the end, that even went to hell. You know, the neglect and the alcohol left me without money to do what I loved. It left me to neglect the animals overnight, letting them pee in the house and poop and, you know, and I neglected myself. I was in a relationship for 5 years with a guy who was a serious alcoholic. I wasn't. I just drank because he was mean to me. And that's my mindset. I never identified that I had any... way to get out in the end. I kept looking for these weird little solutions, and usually it was somebody that was going to save me. And that's what brought me to the bottom. This is from my police report. I was not able or willing to read my police report from my second DUI until a few months ago when I applied for a probation job with the state of Florida, and I finally pulled it out. Even when I applied for a teaching job a couple years ago, I never read it. I just copied it and sent it off. And then finally, a couple months ago, I chose to read the police report, and there's this one paragraph that kind of sums me up at the end, and I'll be sober by 8:30. This is the police officer Krakovich talking to Martinson, who was drunk. At one point, I went back and spoke with Martinson, who was crying. I cried a lot back then, and many of you say I probably cry a lot today. I asked Martinson for her driver's license. Martinson stated she could not find it and began looking through her purse. After approximately 1.5 minutes, I asked Martinson if she had a valid driver's license, and Martinson stated she did not, and again began to cry. I asked who Martinson was, and she ID'd herself to me verbally and told me her middle initial was S, which stood for shithead. Martinson continued to cry, telling me that she was trying to move to Florida to be with her boyfriend and was getting her life back on track. Martinson continued to cry while she kept telling me that she was a shithead. So that really about sums it up. You know, I had rear-ended an elderly gentleman at an intersection near my house. I was driving the car for a deputy sheriff friend of mine who was too drunk to drive. And when I got pulled over, she got out to check on the gentleman, and I switched over into the other seat, thinking I was going to get out of it, or I don't know. I was just insane. I knew I was screwed. And rethought it a little bit, and then switched back into the driver's seat. And then the insanity that pursued from them was that they didn't believe that I was driving, they thought I was trying to cover for Deputy West. And in the end, you know, when I went back to Wisconsin for court, because I had moved to Florida because I was getting my life back on track, you know, I explained that I was a good friend to people, but not that good a friend, and I wasn't going to take a second DUI just to save her butt. And that kind of made sense to him, and I went to jail. And, you know, the humbling process had begun. It simply was not acceptable to me to be sitting in jail. You know, I contemplated the fact that no matter what I thought about my dad and his drinking, he never went to jail. And before that, I have to say, even after the second DUI that I was facing, it occurred to me a week later to take another drink. And I was scared to not drink because I was in so much fear. And then I was angry because I couldn't drink. And then the guy that I was moving to Florida with to change my life and get it back on track said, you know, you're not going to do this again. You're not going to get another DUI. If you want to drink, drink. And he was a normal drinker. God bless him. He was, I think, you know, when Yvonne talked, she talked about taking hostages. The poor guy had no clue what he got himself into. And what I was at the end was this kind of shithead that thought that this guy was going to save her, and we started this sort of long-distance thing. He was somebody I grew up with, and I knew as a child, so he was safe and comfortable, and developed this, you know, romance 1,200 miles apart, and, you know, for his own reasons, and it's not my job to take his inventory, he felt like he could help me, save me, and love me into wellness, and that proved to not be the case. I had my last drink on June 19th of 2002, and I spent the next 6 months understanding what the mental and spiritual part of this disease meant. I was an untreated alcoholic who was scared to take a drink, but was on her way to some sort of huge meltdown spiral. Even though I had changed location and changed my choice of beverage, nothing felt better. Nothing at all. I felt ugly, you know, and my outside reflected it. I was close to 200 and some pounds when I came into this program. And I was unwell. I was starting to get really angry and throw things. And around December, right after Christmas, you know, he sat down and said, "You need to go. You know, this isn't working. It might be time for you to go home." And I didn't want to do that because I knew if I went home that there was nothing there. At least that's what I perceived. It wasn't a safe place. I knew I was at least safe in his house because he didn't drink, and that he wanted to take care of me, but I was just turning kind of nuts. And I went to Lakeside. I don't know if any of you have been to that fine establishment. But, wait a minute. Rigorous honesty. I went in and just laid it out there to the lady and told her my whole story, and she gave me this pseudo-diagnosis of bipolar disorder, and I was really willing to accept that, no, it was my solution. It wasn't funny because I was really happy. I was happy that somebody was going to tell me what the heck was wrong with me. And I loved that. everything was scary. I was still in a lot of fear, but maybe I was going to figure out what the sickness was inside me. And because I couldn't figure it out, it never occurred to me that I was alcoholic because I could put the drink down. And the catch to that whole deal was that I couldn't see the actual psychiatrist for 2 months. And I didn't think I had 2 months at that point. And I went back home and I went on the internet and I looked up all the information about bipolar disorder and thought, well, maybe it was borderline disorder. And I had been spending the whole summer watching Dr. Phil for the solution as well. And wasn't getting anywhere really. But again, just searching and searching and searching and searching, and then getting really, really tired of the search and teetering on the edge of something that was scaring the crap out of me. I knew that it was a do or die kind of thing. And I had a friend, a teacher friend from Wisconsin, give me a call, and because she was coming to Orlando, and she just made the mistake of asking me how I was, and I told her. And she, I had known this for years, was in Al-Anon, because she had been married to an alcoholic and actually remarried an alcoholic, but this one was in recovery. And I said, you know, maybe I need to go to Al-Anon. I said, you know, my mom, when I left Wisconsin, was drinking almost the same way I was in a lot of ways. And I've been affected by alcoholism all my life. And she laughed and said, Jamie, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Get your butt to AA. And so that's what it took for me, was a suggestion of a friend. And I got on the internet and found a place that I knew I could get to by bus. And plotted out the route, because at that point I needed to have every single thing planned, because I was so scared and so dysfunctional. And I remember walking out that door. I was to the point where I couldn't look in the mirror. I couldn't pick myself out of bed, really. But I knew I needed to get here. And then I got on the bus, and I remember thinking, what if nobody's there, you know? And I got to Central at about 11 o'clock. We was in our old little house, and nobody was here. So I sat on the bench and tried to figure out what I was going to do next. And Warren pulled up in his truck. And, I know these days that we newcomers look like deer caught in headlights, usually. And he sat down and sort of patted me on the back and said, "You're new." And Martin soon continued to cry, you know. And he talked to me and said I was in the right place. And that was good news. That was the best news I'd heard in a long time. This guy wasn't pushing me away. And when he kind of go to the meeting, he got up and he knew that I was like a little Velcro cotton ball bunny who was stuck to him. And he walked through the big room knowing that I didn't want to be seen, really, and planted me in the tiny half measures room in the Central building. And I looked for him the next day and realized he never goes to that meeting, but he knew I needed to be there. And when I sat down, David, who was chairing the meeting, asked if there was somebody new. And I knew I had this nylon windbreaker you got free with a pair of rock ports that had holes in the armpits and stuff, and I had up over my head and I was curled up in the chair. And then he said, "Welcome." And I was like, "All right." And then I Madison continued to cry. But it was a sense of relief that was starting to come over me because they did a first step meeting. And everyone told their story of how powerless they felt when they walked in the rooms and how devastated their spirits were. And that's when I started hearing the spirit stuff. And it didn't repulse me the way it did when I was learning to write sermon reports. And I came back, the next day and the next day. And for me, there was no choice. I had found my place. And people petted me and told me everything was going to be okay. Every little bit of you are not alone and how important is it, and one day at a time started to seep in. And it was a huge, huge relief. And all I needed to do, they said, was to keep coming back. I picked up a little job at Panera, which I found is an AA starting point for a lot of people. It's right down on the corner of Lake Eola and Robinson. And I would hike out at 5 a.m. to catch the bus. And the first time I got out there, I thought, last time I was up at 5 a.m., I was coming home. And I would come to the 6 o'clock meeting, 6:30 meeting. I'd get here at 6, and George would let me in and serve up the coffee. And there were a few folks there at the 6:30 meeting that took me under my wing. And we'd go down to Panera before my shift and have a meeting after the meeting. And I just started seeping in, letting it come in, however it was going to come in. And continued on a daily basis to just be willing to see what you guys had to offer, because I knew I was pretty clueless. And remember my first day of work at Panera, I was wearing the boyfriend's khaki pants and the yellow shirt and hat and feeling like a bloated banana. And I was bussing tables, and my sponsor, I'd gotten a sponsor, and the only reason I'm going to say this, but I got my first sponsor was she called me, and I was too afraid. I got that list at that first meeting, and wasn't really willing to call. And I really, really don't think that enough people in this room call the newcomer. Because if you remember how afraid you were, they say you got to be willing to do whatever it takes, but there's a certain amount of fear, and it's the ego holding us back. We're not good enough. They don't want to talk to us. We know what it is, but I have found that reaching out to the newcomer after the meeting and when you get home at night sometimes makes a difference. Anyway, it made a difference with me. She was not my sponsor for very long, but I did learn a lesson from her, and it came that first day of work at Panera when I had to clean her dishes off the table, and she kind of looked at me and picked up on my just sort of disdainful attitude. There was no sense of gratitude, really. It was like, this freaking sucks, and I don't want to do it. And she read that off of me. I didn't say that, but she knew what I was thinking, and she said, well, I guess this is an opportunity for you to practice your humility. And I became teachable for another moment. And that made sense. That's what we do, Those first three steps serve to get us out of the driver's seat. Because I wanted to drive the car, and we all know what happened when I drive the car. And it's not good. And I took a while getting through 1, 2, and 3, and it's just my story. I did my fourth step at 1.5 years sober. I didn't really recommend it to anybody. I didn't see the need to take a drink. I was just kind of grooving on the fellowship, and fear was grooving in my life. It's like, I have to write this crap down. I don't think so. And I, right before I took hard look at my fourth step. I had switched sponsors and started the steps over, and just after I had done my third step, it's the dog story now for you that have heard me speak before, but I had started a fourth step with the sponsor before that, so I had written a fear list. And on the top of that fear list was losing my old dog, Simon. He was the 12-year-old Australian Shepherd that I owned and had traveled many, many miles with. And after I left Panera, I got a job at a veterinary clinic in Lake Mary. And this is when the God stuff started kicking in. Because I kept thinking, I'm not getting it, I'm going to go drink, because I don't know God, you know, or whatever. I never really truly felt on the edge of a drink, but I felt that I was on the edge of AA, that I wasn't getting something. And all it was God, you know, getting me, because I remained willing, and it just took some time. And I got a job at a veterinary clinic, and the purpose was twofold for that, and the reason down the road became clear of why, you know, I worked at that clinic. But initially it was because this veterinarian I worked for was a spiritual witch doctor. I learned amazing things from that man, and just by his nature and his way of being. And then Simon, shortly after I did my third step, got sick. I took him into the clinic. He started seizing, and I immediately melted. I just lost it. I carried my dog in, tears, everything. He's gonna die, he's gonna die, he's gonna die. And Doc took the dog from me, and he looked at me and he said, he might die. That's what we do, you know. Animals die, people die. He said, this isn't about the dog, this is about you. And I wanted to slap him. I was in pain, and a pain that I hadn't felt since I got sober. And I didn't know how the hell I was going to handle it. And he just looked at me and continued. He said, when Simon's ready to go, we'll know. And it'll be his time. There's nothing you can do about it. And he said, this isn't about the dog. This is about you. I went home that night and took my dog, who continued to have these horrible seizures. And up until that point, I'd been lying about getting on my knees in the morning and lying about, you know, praying at night. I would lay in bed and ask God, you know, keep me sober. I would go through a list of blessings, the people that I wanted to bless, you know, but I had never gotten on my knees, and that night I knew something had to change. If I was going to walk through this, if I was going to stay sober. And so I got on my knees, and I asked God. I said, if you're there, you know, this is the kind of prayer that you usually hear when people are walking into the rooms. If you're there, I need you right now. Help me, guide me, walk me through this, because I don't know how to do it. And from my knees, I went flat out on my belly, my arms out, with one hand over my dog, and just asked for help. And that's all I could do at that moment. And when I got up the next morning, I slept on the floor with the dog, and my little new puppy, Scout, had curled up with us. And, you know, I'm sure people are sick of the dog story, but, you know, God apparently talks to me through my pets. And I took Simon into the clinic the next morning, and Doc said, it's time for him to go. And I just said, okay, can we take him outside? And he's like, yeah. And so we went out back, and we sat down on the curb, and he looked at me, and he said, you know, when you look in the mirror, you don't see the beautiful person that we all see. And he said, you know, this dog has had his life, good, bad, ugly, wonderful, whatever it is, it's been his life, and it's his time to go. He's not going to feel any pain. You can choose to walk through this or not. and I had taken time the night before to recognize what it was that I was unwilling to let go of. And a lot of it was guilt. A lot of it was putting faith in something that could go at any minute and not relying upon God. So at that moment, my last touchstone that was keeping me from connecting up there left the earth. And he said, "I am. You have given him his life." He said, "Let him," and it's been what it is, and it's been mostly wonderful, and you know that. "Let him do you a favor. Let him give you a gift. Let him take all of those things that you hold on to that are preventing you from being the person you're meant to be, the spirit that is meant to live inside you." You know, it was a convoluted fourth, fifth, third step experience where he was asking me to let go of the wreckage and move on with my life. And he injected that dog, and he put his hand on the dog, and he put his hand on me. And I remember making a conscious effort to feel how he felt, and I made a conscious effort to just be. And there was an energy, whether you believe it or not, that transcended from the dog to me to God. And when I opened my eyes, the dog was gone. I was still here, and there was a sense that everything was going to be okay. And from that moment on, I was ready and willing to do whatever it took to complete the steps most of the time. We're human, and that's it. This is a journey of humans who are flawed. They're physically allergic to alcohol. If they don't take care of their spiritual and mental condition, their body tells them to drink. And that is it. We are, you know, people act surprised when people go back out, you know. That's what we do. That's what brings us together in this room, is the physical component of our bodies that make us different from the average normal drinker. So when we don't attend to our spiritual condition and try to align our will with God's, we drink. I'm going to fast forward a little bit to just this past year and the gifts that this program has offered me. Every day that I choose to continue to walk the walk, this paragraph became very important to me a few months ago when I thought, you know, in my mind that I had reached what I considered to be my promises. You know, the last few months, since sort of February, March, has been a lesson in basically surrender on a daily basis. We come into these rooms just toppled over, and it's easy for us to surrender. And for me, at 3.5 years sober, I was just feeling all right. And that's okay. That's what we do. We feel all right. And then something happens, and the rug gets pulled out from underneath us. And then it's like rubber meets the road moment, you know? And it is easy to let up on this spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have, is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. How quickly, when we get a little walking around sense, does my will you know, I have to speak for myself because there are people that live this program on a daily basis that have walked me through these hard times. But everyone is human. And this human thought she was making choices that were aligned with God, and maybe they were. And then stuff happens and it changes, and everything that you know to be true is different. Our relationship ended in March, and 2 weeks later, my job was eliminated. And I was at a place of, what the hell is going on? What do I do? And I remember waking up and contemplating leaving my job at this veterinary clinic that had given me so much and talked to. I had gone to a spiritual advisor lady that I like, and, you know, in my journey to kind of grow my spirit, we do things outside the program. And just talked to her and talked to my friend Stephanie and Julie at that time. And I heard, honor your spirit. You know, what is your spirit telling you? And that was a spirit that that had been talking to me for 36 years before I came into this program that I didn't know how to listen to. I had to clear the junk out. And my spirit was telling me I needed to go. I needed to move on. I needed to do something different. I'm not sure what roles are being assigned me, but it was a new role. Julie told me, you help others. And she pushed me into sponsorship at a higher level of being. I've been afraid to sponsor. You know, you don't want to ruin somebody you don't know how to do it well enough. You know, how can you ruin somebody who's ruined? But, you know. It's not true, but it kind of is, you know. We can offer what we know to be true in this program. And as simple as that. You don't ruin anybody, you just offer them the steps. You're not a counselor. You're not anything but a vehicle by which God contacts them by step 12. Anyway, I'm running out of time. I have to say, God speaks to me through my pets. I woke up a Friday morning, and it was March 31st, and 2 years before that was the day that Simon was put to sleep. And I prayed to God. I said, I'm something about spring and March where I'm meeting these challenges in my life. And I acknowledged his work in my life for the last 2 years. And I acknowledged my dog that I still love, you know, and the lesson that I learned 2 years ago about surrender. And walked into work that day. And certain sense of peace, a contentment that I was going to give my notice and leave. I didn't have a job lined up, but I was going to leave. You know, that just was what I needed to do. And Chrissy, a friend that I work with, called, and she said, you're not going to believe this. And I said, what? She goes, you remember when we went to the beach? And it was about 3 weeks before Simon died. She goes, there was a roll of film sitting on my dresser today. And I just thought I needed to develop it. And she said, Jamie, there's a beautiful picture of him in there. And it's like he's looking at the camera saying, it's all good. She said that. And she said, I'm bringing it to you. And so she came to work, and she handed me a picture of my dog looking at the camera saying, it's all good. And I said, you don't know what day this is, do you? She said, what? I said, it was 2 years ago today that we put Simon to sleep. Whatever, you know. There are some things that are undefinable and unexplainable in this program and in God's realm. And each day that I spent since I chose to leave that job was a day of conscious surrender. I read a new pair of glasses again, and there's a section in there where Chuck C. talks about being 3.5 years sober, and he talks about hitting a wall and having to consciously surrender for the first time in his sobriety. And for me, that has been my lesson. I walked through a summer of cleaning houses, doing construction work at night at subways. calling myself the sponsees, making announcements at meetings, and then finding a beautiful sponsee to sponsor, and the gifts that have come from breaking it down and getting back to basics. My car, brakes went out in my car. I coasted through a light and pulled into a parking lot just shaking, but so thankful God was with me. And Roy came to help me and talked about fear. You know, there have been people that have been absolutely instrumental in getting the message across to me. Getting to the beach, communing with the waves. Standing on my own two feet. Knowing that God's working in my life. And that it's not about the relationship, not about the job. I decided I was going to be a probation officer, at least try. And went through this arduous process of having to reveal my alcoholism. And what initially brought me very far in the interview process was what barred me from the job. And I sat across the table from the woman in this sort of half-hour discourse on alcoholism and what it would do. It was just a really clarifying moment that this is who I am. And an acceptance that we get in here, we hunker down with each other, we are who we are, there's 100% level of acceptance, and that this world offers consequences for our behaviors, and they may take 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, or never to be rectified. But I left that meeting, and 2 days later, I was told that I wasn't able to have that job, and felt somewhat defeated. But also, again, every moment that I chose to walk through this journey with God and with the friends that amaze me on a daily basis is a day when I grow. 4 days later, I sat down for lunch with a veterinarian friend of mine, and she came and was pulling her hair out because she had bought a veterinary practice and didn't know what the heck was going on. She said, I need a manager. And she looked at me, and I just shook my head, and she goes, you're not going back into vet medicine. I said, nope. I wasn't going until right then. And out of left field, what I believed to be true. And I had looked at my resume after getting that job rejection and said, oh my God, look at this. I have a chunk of time here at this vet clinic. I have a chunk of time here in retail. I have a chunk of time in grooming. I have shown dogs. And I have a degree in education. What the hell am I going to do? Everything that I apply for in teaching is going to open me up to the scrutiny of the record. And then here God comes and says, it's an opportunity. And here I am, you know, the animal services manager of a veterinary boarding kennel grooming facility that's attached to airport shuttle parking. It's the most bizarre thing on earth. But the only thing like it in the country, you know, it's awesome in that they think I can do it, and I have to try to remember that every experience I've had up to the point has prepared me for it. I go in with a deep sense of humility and gratitude. I got a business card that kind of bolts my head up, but then, you know, we shot the commercial the other day, and I'm thinking, oh God, it's coming. My friends and this program, and I am just so thankful for each and every one of you that touch my life on a daily basis. Thank you. Yes.